Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and we're here today with a very eminent scientist up in Massachusetts, someone at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who's done some remarkable work on trying to take simple chemicals and find out how they have impact on biological systems. It all started many years ago in Michigan State when a very astute scientist, Professor Rosenberg, found out that certain bacteria were growing in a very curious manner. They weren't reproducing under the influence of platinum. And that generated what I'm sure a lot of you know, that is the cisplatin family of drugs. Well, our guest today, Steve Liphard, up there in Massachusetts, has sort of gone onto this area and done a really fine study. And we're a lot further along with the use of these materials as drugs than we were 30, 40 years ago. So, Steve Liphard, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you for having me.
Now, before we get into you and your studies, and not just on cisplatin and things of that nature, but others, tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get to be a scientist? What were your sort of formative years all about?
Well, I grew up in Pittsburgh in the 40s and was very much influenced by my science classes, among others. We had Fisher Scientific in town. I enjoyed chemical magic, and in those days you could go down to Fisher and buy just about any chemical over the counter. One of my favorites was calcium carbide, which when you put it in water makes acetylene, and the acetylene gas settles on top of the water. You put a match on it and you have water with a burning gas on the top, which is kind of dramatic. I enjoyed that demonstration until one day I made the mistake of doing it in my mother's laundry room, and the sooty flame produced blackened clothing and stopped me from home experimentation from that point on. So I was certainly interested in chemistry. I had a wonderful high school chemistry teacher who actually was so well known as public school in Pittsburgh that he was stolen away before I could take his honors course by Olin Matheson down in Louisiana, where they were setting up a high school for the children of their employees, so I had a somewhat less exciting teacher in 11th grade. But all of this was sort of heading me towards medical school. My uncle was a physician, and I strongly admired him, so I basically went off to college with the idea of doing pre-medical studies.
Did you study in Pennsylvania?
I did. I went to a small liberal arts college outside of Philadelphia called Haverford College. It was not very well known in those days, although it was rated number one male liberal arts college. I just happened to find it because a fellow I taught horseback riding with in Ohio during the summer went there. He was 2 years older than me, and I admired him greatly, and so I explored Haverford and went. It had 450 total men there at the time. Many of the liberal arts colleges were not co-ed back then. And I was a pre-med, and it was somewhat fashionable to major in the arts rather than the sciences, so I was a pre-med English major for several years until chemistry courses more or less overtook my interest, and I switched over to a chemistry major late in the game.
Well, was there an all-female college close by? It seems to me that these male colleges are always strategically located near a female college.
Yes, there was Bryn Mawr College, which
right.
is much better known. Bryn Mawr, Haverford, and Swarthmore are three Quaker-founded colleges in the Pennsylvania, eastern Pennsylvania area around Philadelphia. So there was Bryn Mawr College.
It's like wet and dry counties in Texas. You know, you never get one without the other. It's a great concept. So where did you go to graduate school?
I went to MIT.
Okay, so you're an alumnus, and now you're a faculty member there. So that's
But I'm
nice.
Not a lifer.
What does that mean?
When I finished my PhD and a short postdoc thereafter, I went to Columbia University in New York, and I spent almost 17 years at Columbia. That's where I got my work going, and then I came back to MIT in December of 82.
Okay. All right, let's talk a little bit about your work, and then let's start off at least with this business of the platinum drugs. Why don't you tell the story in your own way of what fascinated you by those early Rosenberg studies?
Well, actually, my own personal involvement began somewhat before then. Among the early experiments that I was doing at Columbia was to attempt to sequence the human genome, is how we would put it today, although it wasn't discussed back then in those terms, get the sequence of the bases in DNA by attaching heavy metals to base-specific sites with the ultimate aim of spreading the DNA out on an electron microscope grid and then reading the dots on the line of DNA that would allow one to identify specific nucleotides. So, as we know, DNA is made up of four building blocks, guanine, cytosine, adenine, and thymine. And we found a way to put a chemical label just before each guanine in the DNA strand. And that method involved incorporating a sulfur atom in place of an oxygen atom. That was studies that had been done by Fritz Eckstein in Germany. And in collaboration with Fritz, who helped provide us some materials, we were able then to attach heavy metals specifically at those sites. And it was pretty good chemistry, but the method failed at the microscopic examination. One had to use a scanning transmission electron microscope in order to visualize single atoms on an electron microscope grid, and the amount of energy required to put in caused the images to be slightly blurred so that we couldn't get a really good reading of the sequence. This was many years before the solution methods came along that ultimately allowed us to get sequences of DNA.
What were the metals that you were using in those days?
Well, you want a heavy electron-dense metal, so we chose to use mercury, gold, and platinum. And so we became rather good at understanding how metal ions interact with nucleic acids. And in fact, during the process, we discovered a form of binding of metal complexes to DNA for which we coined the term metallointercalation, that is, metal ions that bind to ligands, units that hold them, that can insert in between the base pairs in the stack of the double helix of DNA. So that's how metallointercalators were discovered.
I didn't realize that. So this was when? This is in the early 70s?
Yes. The work actually that we did started in the late 60s, and the metallointercalators were discovered. We discovered those about 72, 73, published the first papers then. And using X-ray crystallography and fiber diffraction, which is the technique that Maurice Wilkins used to get the famous cross structure of DNA for which he shared the Nobel Prize, we were able to see the regular periodic spacing of platinum intercalators along the DNA backbone, and to prove something called the neighbor exclusion model. When you have an intercalator go between adjacent base pairs, the next nearest neighbor interbase pair sites are excluded. So we could see these beautiful additional reflections onto the famous Wilkins pattern. So that was an exciting, rather thrilling moment when we saw that.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, I like to find out, what did you feel when you first saw that? I mean, did you go out and have big drinks?
It was spectacular. We were collaborating with Bob Langridge and a guy named Peter Bond, who was one of his postdocs, who had the ability to make fibers of DNA and to study them by fiber X-ray diffraction. And I remember being with my graduate student, Karen Wetterhahn, down at Princeton, because Langridge was at Princeton. It was an easy drive from New York to get from Columbia down to Princeton. And we worked all through the day, and in the evening we got the first pictures. And it was just one of those truly thrilling moments where you have, you know, shining through in a simple picture a very deep insight into how nature works.
Now, did you jump from there very quickly into the whole concept of metallotherapy?
Not really. I was certainly aware of the Rosenberg discovery of the anti-cancer activity of platinum compounds in, 1965. He had the first clue that platinum compounds could affect the division of DNA in cell culture, that's E. coli cells. And in 1969, he had the first experimental evidence in animals that there could be some curative effect for tumors. And so, you know, by the time the early to mid-70s rolled around, I figured that, well, I should say, first of all, that DNA had been implicated as a significant target by people who had worked in the field and were attracted by the Rosenberg discovery, including Rosenberg himself. And one of the things that he found was that certain oligonucleotides turned blue when you added cisplatin to them. And that drew my attention to a class of compounds known as platinum blues. And sort of simultaneously, we began to study platinum binding to DNA and the platinum blues. And one of the interesting early discoveries, also equally thrilling to the metallointercalation, was when we were able to get the the crystal structure for the first time of a platinum blue, which turns out to contain four of the cisplatin units, diamine platinum, bridged by pyrimidine bases. We actually used alpha pyridone, which is not a pyrimidine base but an analog. So we could see a little four platinum stack, and we could see that it had platinum in the mixed valences. So there were three platinums in the formal plus two oxidation state, like cisplatin, and one in the plus three state, generating a hole in that stack. And if you did a simple particle in a box calculation, you could tell that there should be about a 700 nanometer optical band, which is what you would expect for a blue color. So that was another really thrilling discovery, because platinum blues have been known for over 100 years, and nobody really knew why they were blue or what they were. So that was a second thing that came along in those early days. And shortly thereafter, we began to look in some detail as to how and why and in what manner platinum compounds would modify DNA, with the simple question of, you know, how did these compounds cure cancer?
For the listener, the very first cisplatin compounds, so the platinum is what we call square planar. It's just taking a square and taking the diagonals, the platinum's in the middle, and you can have two isomers. You can have the two nitrogens across the diagonal, or you can have them on a side, and then the two chlorines will fit in. And so that was the first basic simple molecule. But then, from then on, you've simply been modifying the nitrogens so that now you've got all sorts of funny organic groups over there, and there's a whole Pandora's box that chemists like to play with. I mean, that's what we do. We like to make new molecules, right?
Yes. I mean, for the listener who's not too experienced with inorganic geometry and stereochemistry, I like to say that it's like a baseball diamond with the platinum on the pitcher's mound. And if you have two ammonia molecules, NH3, and two chlorine ions, Cl-, the ammonias can be on first and second, or they can be on first and third, with chlorine atoms occupying the other bases. And those represent the two isomers.
That's right.
Intriguing things in the early days was, why was it that the molecule with runners on first and second, the so-called cis isomer next to each other, seemed to be active, whereas the trans isomer was inactive? And it seemed like that there was the stereochemistry of the binding to targets on DNA that would make that difference.
Yeah, it's nice that you can use a baseball analogy, because I was going to think about how does cricket fit into this, and rugby and football, and of course it doesn't. We're going to take a break. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and I'm here with Steve Lippard from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Most stories involve love, whether it's in movie or song. But in opera, you can also find chemistry.
Wait, isn't that love too?
Not that chemistry. I mean literally chemistry. The storylines of some operas involve poisons, love potions, and even pharmacists. A recent article grouped them into four categories related to chemistry.
The first is apothecary operas, which involve chemists or pharmacists. Io Campanello, composed by Donizetti in 1836, tells of a wealthy elderly pharmacist who marries a beautiful young woman. He's kept from their marriage bed by her former fiancé, who appears in various guises throughout the night, requesting preposterous prescriptions.
The second group of operas involve poisonous natural products. A French opera by Ambroise Thomas in 1868 sang of Hamlet's father being assassinated by his brother, who pours henbane extract into his ear while he slept. The plan can cause hallucinations, coma, and death.
There are also operas composed around the great poisoners of history, such as the story of Antony and Cleopatra. Apparently, Cleopatra tested different poisons on poor or sick people, and although unproven, some say she killed herself by snakebite.
Finally, there are the arsenic operas. In a Giuseppe Verdi opera, the title character is poisoned by his future son-in-law.
The connection between chemistry and operas isn't so surprising when you look around and find chemistry in our everyday lives, from our cleaning products to our medicines. Plus, I'd venture to say, without chemistry, some operas would not have much to sing about.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell with Steve Lippard from Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And we're talking about a family of platinum compounds, which are now platinum drugs that are widely used for treatment of cancers. So, Steve, going back to those early discoveries with the simpler means, and now we've got all of these plethora of different types of molecule, why don't you give us an update on where we are right now with this type of molecule?
Okay, well, sort of proceeding from that early history, first of all, we began to investigate whether there were specific targets on DNA that the cisplatin compound found. And the short answer is there are. And in particular, the platinum likes to bind to two adjacent guanine bases. That's one of the four bases of the DNA double helix. And when it does that, it causes a kink or a bend in the DNA. And we were able to make these adducts in the test tube and to crystallize them and to get their three-dimensional geometries by X-ray crystallography, both at the simple dinucleotide level, GPG, P meaning the intervening phosphodiester linkage, and also in a DNA double helix, so we could see the same bending phenomenon take place. And so then the question is, if that occurs, what about that leads to the killing of the cancer cell, and then specifically, what about that leads to the selective killing of cancer cells compared to normal cells, and what about the platinum binding leads to toxicities? So quite a lot of time transpired over the course of that time. We evolved what I think is a pretty accurate mechanism of what's occurring. It's basically, we think, the inhibition of RNA polymerase II, the major enzyme in the nucleated cells that's necessary to transcribe the DNA into RNA in the process ultimately of making proteins. And when that happens, then the cells don't go into cell division, and there can be processes that lead to death pathways in the cell, and hopefully one would like to see that in the cancer cell. Now, 50% of all patients who are treated for cancer in the United States, approximately 50%, are treated with platinum drugs now. So there's been a tremendous resurgence and large distribution of platinum throughout the medical community in treating cancer. And so, in addition to cisplatin, there are two other molecules that have been released by the FDA. One is known as carboplatin, which has fewer toxic side effects, where the chlorides are replaced by another unit. And then another one called oxaloplatin, where there are some organic units, as you mentioned earlier, on the amines. I mean, cisplatin has only 11 atoms, no carbon atoms. Oxaloplatin and carboplatin are slightly more complicated and have fewer toxic side effects. But we've been very interested in actually trying to do much better, because although cisplatin is a cure for testicular cancer, literally, there's very few deaths of testicular cancer, one would like to see it applied to a much wider range of cancers, lung, breast, colon, and so forth. And so we've been working toward that end in recent years. And one of the ways that we've done this, and we've recently published a paper very recently, which we're quite excited about, is to move from the simple baseball analogy planar platinum compounds in the plus 2 oxidation state to platinum compounds which are in the plus 4 oxidation state. So with simple chemical reagents like hydrogen peroxide, you can oxidize cisplatin to a molecule in which there are a fifth and sixth ligand. So imagine above and below the pitcher in the pitcher's mound, using the earlier analogy. And those ligands serve as an attachment point for putting additional molecules on that can both allow one to encapsulate the resulting compound in a nano carrier, and in certain cases potentiate the intracellular activity of the platinum compound by turning on an additional mechanism of toxicity. And I won't go through all the different compounds that we've made, and many of them are quite exciting, and we hope to be able to get into the clinic in the not-too-distant future. But I'll tell you just about one, which I mentioned we just published, that we call mitoplatin, M-I-T-A-P-L-A-T-I-N. When these platinum 4 compounds with the extra two pieces on them get inside the cell, the intracellular milieu is capable of reducing them back from platinum 4 to platinum 2. Thereby liberating cisplatin, the initial compound, and two additional things. As I mentioned, those additional things can be various and sundry units. But if they are dichloroacetate, very simple anion, dichloroacetate, two chlorines on vinegar, basically, the dichloroacetate had been known, and this is what inspired me to think about this, to be involved in the selective toxicity of cancer cells. Now, why does it do that? Well, it does it because the cancer cell operates under something known as the Warburg effect, after Otto Warburg, who discovered it many, many decades ago. And that is the following. As cancer cells begin to become transformed, they are often in an anoxic environment. And so the mitochondrion, which is the powerhouse of the cell, needs oxygen for glucose oxidation. Glucose makes ATP, which powers the cell. But if oxygen gets to be in short supply, that can't happen. And so the cancer cell switches over its mitochondrial function from glucose oxidation to glycolysis. Okay, so it metabolizes glucose in a non-O2 requiring manner. And even though as the cancer cells evolve, they will become aerobic again, that switch is still there. There's a lot of interest now in mitochondrial metabolism as a way of attacking cancer cells because it's one metabolic process, one clear metabolic process, that clearly distinguishes cancer cells from normal cells.
And, of course, that's the key feature because so many of the drugs that we use, and in particular these metallo-based drugs, if you don't have them very specifically aiming at a cancer cell, they have the same capacity to kill and stop the reproduction of healthy cells. And so, you know, some people have claimed that, you know, this is it's a 21st century methodology for treating cancer that will simply look quite barbaric in about another 100 years.
Well, there are people who feel that now, but I don't have time to go into this in detail, but we think there are reasons why cisplatin produces cures of cancer. You know, Lance Armstrong, the cyclist, is the poster child for this. I mean, he had stage 4 metastatic testicular cancer. It was in his brain. He was treated from cancer with cisplatin, and he was completely cured.
The implication, Steve, is that cisplatins are pretty competent of attacking any cancer cell. Am I correct there?
They're very potent. You know, and we have some theories about why it is that testicular cancer is so well treated with this, but we just don't have time to go into those technical details, and we haven't completely proved it. That is, you know, it's, you know, unlike some of the things I mentioned earlier, you know, we haven't had that total moment of euphoria where we feel we've sorted the whole thing out from soup to nuts, but we think we're pretty close to an understanding, and we continue to investigate along those lines. But getting back to mitoplatin, if I may,
yes,
what we did was to attach the dichloroacetate, and we discovered that this platinum-4 compound, that's the oxidation state compared to plus-2, which is cisplatin, had very high potency against cancer cells in culture. And that was exciting to us because typically the platinum-4 compounds are less reactive in general. And so we knew that there was something that the dichloroacetate was doing. So, for example, if you just use acetate instead of dichloroacetate, you didn't see that. Well, when we co-cultured normal fibroblasts with cancer cells, we found that mitoplatin had the extraordinary ability to kill selectively only the cancer cell while leaving the normal fibroblasts intact at the levels in which we used it. So we thought, well, this is too good to be true, but we're quite convinced that it's reproducible, and we've definitely proved that it has to do with the mitochondrial membrane potential changes and all the other things that accompany the mitochondrial metabolism change that's brought about by dichloroacetate. So these compounds are now in animals. I can tell you in unpublished work that we know that their toxicity is, at least in mice, a factor of 10 less toxic than cisplatin, which we're very excited about. That's just normal, you know, not cancer containing, not cancerous mice, but normal mice.
Right.
And so with these compounds, and indeed with any cancer treatment, you have a window of activity below which the bottom sill of the window, there's no effectiveness, and above which, in the level of drug administered, it's toxic. So you obviously want to be as wide as possible. And what we've done, at least so far as our current experiments are concerned, we believe, is to raise the upper sash of that window by about a factor of 10. And now experiments will begin within a couple of weeks where we will look at so-called xenografts in mice and see whether when we put cancer tissue in there, we will get the selective kill that cisplatin gives. And if so, we hope to get to a clinical trial as soon as we can. After all this time, Keith, I would like to say that I've cured at least one person of cancer before I leave the planet.
Well, presumably you've got a few more years to go yet.
I hope so.
Okay, Steve. So, in fact, what you're saying here is, of course, what America prides itself on. That is, you know, a fundamentally excellent research establishment that's capable of taking research and putting it out there and transferring the technology, in your case, into medicine. Do you yourself have any startup companies that you're associated with or have spawned?
I actually have avoided that through most of my career. I'm a real academic.
Right.
However, I will say that, you know, if the mitoplatin, or as some of my friends have told me I should call it, we call it mita for mitochondria, but some of my friends say I should really call it mitoplatin for my institution. If that looks good, and some of the other molecules, especially with the nanocarriers, you know, we have some of these that target specifically prostate cancer tissue, and other markers on cancer cells. As that moves along, I should say that I am contemplating spinning off a company that would help to raise the funds to allow us to get to the costly next stage in the process, which is carrying out clinical trials. Right. And coming back to Barney Rosenberg, I mean, one of the great attributes of the late Barney Rosenberg that I admired most was his ability to act like a Hollywood producer in making a movie. That is, he essentially didn't rest until he got that compound into human patients and curing cancer. And, you know, that's a great inspiration for me. And, you know, now I think that we may actually be, hopefully, knocking at the door of being able to do exactly that.
Well, that's great. And then I can imagine there's going to be a new football stadium at MIT. Do you have one, even? The Lippard Stadium.
Well, I have
Do you play
no
football up there?
For that.
No,
we have
I know
a, we
you
have
don't.
An athletic field. Football is not a major sport at MIT.
Okay.
I do have a music room named after me, however, but that's another story.
What do you play?
Harpsichord.
How often do you play?
Every day. I've been still taking lessons. My wife and I served as housemasters living in a dorm with 350 students in the early 90s for 4 years. That was my way of giving back what I got from Haverford, you know, lots of attention by faculty.
Yeah, absolutely.
And during that time, I gave a course, I did it once, on Baroque musical instruments and performance. It met from 9 to midnight on Monday nights, and we did two performances, public performances, and rented a harpsichord for the music room, and it was a lot of fun, but it was a one-off because that's not what I do in life.
No, but it's giving me the idea. I'm going to invite you down, and you can give a seminar, but you've got to give a concert too. Anyway, Steve Lippard, MIT, thank you very much for being here on Science Studio. And Norma Martinez, thank you for putting it all together. And to the audience, we'll be back again next week with another riveting program. And don't forget that this is brought to you by a kind donation of funds from the Camille and Henry Dreyfuss Fund. So we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Bell Health Investment Partners, a New York-based healthcare equity firm, has agreed to purchase a trio of laboratory companies from NMSU. The purchase was a $5.3 million deal. Nearly $1 million in net proceeds will go to NMSU. Read more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse is brought to you by Sierra Providence Health Network.